Welcome to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore people, stories, and events in Central Iowa. I am Ursula Rudenberg, your host for today. Thank you for joining me to listen in. Today is mostly sunny with a high near 91. By tonight, though, precipitation is likely to start in our area on and off until Friday. However, new rain is likely to amount to less than a tenth of an inch. Not much rain relief in sight for thirsty plants. The weekend is expected to be sunny and around 90 degrees again. A few weeks ago, I was driving down Northwestern Avenue on the way to KHOI when I saw something I'd never seen before. Up ahead, a gray fox ran across the road around 9th Street, and a minute later, it crossed back with a rabbit in its mouth, and then disappeared in the brush by the railroad tracks. At first, I thought I was possibly seeing a dog, but it was clearly not that, and the animal was too small to be a coyote, and so I realized it was a gray fox. I mentioned this to Pat Schlarbaum, KHOI's reporting environmentalist. Pat saw a gray fox as auspicious, and he prepared this report for you. Perhaps you'll see a gray fox trotting across the road as well. There are certainly enough rabbits in Ames to keep a fox happy for a long time.
Phenology is recording nature's happenings on the date they occur. The first hepatica of spring, or the last osprey of autumn, are noted in a journal for future reference. Today's focus on phenology is on gray foxes. Recently, a good friend reported seeing a gray fox right here in Ames, Iowa. Like most wild critters, feeding young is ongoing life's mission in June. So to see a fox during daylight illustrates their 24/7 behavior of hunting for growing young, even during daylight, even in urban areas. Now a great mystery, can the urban forest sustain a recovering population of gray foxes in Iowa? Across Iowa's woodland terrain, gray foxes are becoming increasingly rare. And I use the term there, urban forest. So when we think of all the replacement maples and ash and walnut, when the urban areas were devastated from the Dutch elm disease back in the mid-1960s, there were a lot of tree-lined avenues that lost their elm trees. But now, 50, 60 years later, we're experiencing the growth of a new woodland environment with mature oak, hickory, ash, and hackberry trees, among others. Although there are more than 20 species of foxes, the red fox is decidedly the most common. And red foxes are generally successful in making different environments because of their intelligence. And some species, like the Arctic and the fennec foxes, have evolved with specific morphological adaptations to help them survive extreme climates. Antarctica is the only continent without foxes on the Earth. The less common fox in Iowa, the gray fox, is the only member of the Canidae family that can climb trees. While this practice may seem odd, it's a great way for the fox to make a quick escape from larger predators like coyotes, where there's a lot of territoriality and a lot of conflict between coyotes and foxes in general. There have even been ongoing reports of gray foxes having their kits, or baby foxes, in trees, usually large hollows in the trunk, like a burrow. As a small predator, a fox hunts most efficiently. Different species of foxes may weigh as little as 2 pounds or as many as 30, but even the high end of that scale doesn't guarantee enough strength to bring down prey in the typical canine grab-and-shake fashion. Instead, foxes will carefully target prey and kill it by separating the vertebrae with one bite, like a cat. In snow or grassy fields, foxes can sometimes be seen diving theatrically to get their prey, usually mice. Any critter that can listen and smell their quarry through the snow, then leap into the air and pounce downward nose first, it is a sight to behold. Although foxes may live as long as 20 years in captivity, the average lifespan of a fox in the wild is about 3 years. Across the Midwest, gray fox populations are dwindling, and the cause of the decline has not been determined. Decreasing and degrading habitat could all be factors, and a genetic analysis of gray fox population structure is being done by a coalition of researchers from the Smithsonian Institution, Iowa State University, Luther College, and the Missouri Department of Conservation to better identify detrimental influences and develop conservation plans for the future. The Iowa DNR is participating in this study by collecting gray fox tissue samples from around the state whenever possible. While foxes are members of the dog family and sometimes thought of as carnivores, they are actually omnivores and will quickly change their diets based on what food is available. For urban or suburban dwelling foxes, this may include garbage and pet food. Whereas other environments and seasonal conditions may lead foxes to munch on small game, eggs, fish, frogs, insects, vegetables, grass, berries, fruits, and even worms. Although generally solitary and territorial, a mated pair of foxes will stay together with their litter until the kits are mature. Litters generally range from 2 to 6 kits and are born in the spring, with the kits maturing later that summer. Generally, the family will disband at this point, but sometimes a vixen's mature female kits will help their mother raise the next litter. Foxes generally have their litters in dens, which they either dig or acquire from another resident. It is not uncommon for red foxes to use unoccupied badger dens. Foxes seem to say a lot of things. Actually, they produce vocalizations including whines, barks, yips, huffs, growls, coughs, yowls, howls, and a chattering of sound called geckering. Although many people have heard assorted fox calls, few recognize them as such because foxes are nocturnal and humans don't usually see them make these sounds. Additionally, foxes are physically smaller than most dogs, and their vocalizations seem comparatively high-pitched, sometimes getting them mistaken for owls or other animals in the night. And that's our phonology of gray foxes in Iowa for today.
Thank you, Pat Schlarbaum, for that report. And this is Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. I am Ursula Rudenberg, your host for today. The American Conservative Union Foundation, otherwise known as ACUF, has just released its ratings for the 2017 meeting of the Iowa General Assembly. These ratings, a portion of the comprehensive and nationwide ratings released by the ACUF, are designed to reflect how elected officials view the role of government and are helpful in illustrating how both chambers of the legislature as well as individual members prioritize a wide variety of issue areas that directly affect Iowans. The ACUF has reviewed each piece of legislation voted on in both the Senate and the House of Representatives to produce average scores for each chamber as well as individual scores for each sitting member. According to the ACUF, Iowa lawmakers took pen to paper on various issues during 2017 legislative session, including health insurance mandates, farmer property rights, Christian education curriculum, abortion restrictions, voter ID laws, and income tax regulations. The 2017 Iowa legislature saw both chambers working closely together, passing a good number of bills in both the House and Senate. Most notably, they report, the legislature voted to provide farmers who run animal feeding operations with better protections against nuisance lawsuits, allow Christian education curriculum to be accredited by the State Department of Education, restrict abortions after 5 months of pregnancy, require a photo ID for all voting at polls, and repealed a requirement that tax filers state on their tax returns whether or not each child has health insurance. In their report, the ACUF state that two chambers not only worked together to pass a handful of beneficial legislation this year, but boosted their overall conservative score significantly in each chamber, suggesting the legislative body has seen one of the largest increases in conservative representation in many years. The Iowa Senate's average score increased by 18% this year, from 43% in 2016 to 61% in 2017, and the House's score of increase in conservatism increased by 10%, from 45% in 2016 to 55% this year. Iowa's unified right-leaning government allowed for significant conservative victories, including an overhaul of collective bargaining laws for the first time in 43 years and the ban of project labor agreements, which force companies to negotiate with unions in order to qualify for state contracts. On July 15th, CCI Action, CCI is Iowa Citizens for Community Improvement, will host a statewide conference in Des Moines expressing a different point of view. The conference, called Revolution Iowa, From Protest to Power, will feature keynote speakers Bernie Sanders and Alicia Garza, founder of Black Lives Matter. KHOI reporter Kay Puttock and Joy B. interviewed one of the organizers of the event and filed this report.
I'm Joy B., and I am a new reporter for the local talk team. And my guest today is Evan Berger, who represents an organization called CCI Action for an event that is going to happen in Des Moines called Revolution Iowa. Evan is here to tell us about the event coming up on July 15th. So, Evan, thank you for coming.
Thanks for having
me. Talk with us today.
Yeah.
Tell us more about the purpose of this event.
Definitely, yeah. So this is an annual event that we do. We have a convention every year, and it's really our biggest event of the year. This year is going to be even bigger than ever because we do have a couple great featured speakers, including Senator Bernie Sanders as the keynote speaker, and then Alicia Garza, who's one of the co-founders of Black Lives Matter, is a featured speaker as well. So we're expecting a pretty big event this year. This is the kind of one time every year that we try and build community, discuss strategy, and kind of plan out the next year.
Bernie Sanders, the keynote speaker, he always said that we should have a revolution. Is this a step in that direction?
Yeah, we as an organization did endorse Bernie before the caucuses, and the name is definitely a nod towards him when we call it Revolution Iowa. We've been saying for a long time is we got to get a lot more people involved in the political process. It can't just be cast your vote every 2 years or every 4 years. And so, you know, we like that idea of a political revolution where people are engaged day in and day out. And I think that really is what we're seeing with, you know, the resistance that's kind of come up under Trump is people are really putting that into effect. So, yeah, I mean, I think, you know, we still like what Bernie has to say. He's out there kind of pushing these issues and very excited to hear what he has to say on the 15th.
So this is part of building a mass movement, in other words, that Bernie was talking about during the campaign.
That's the goal, yeah. That would be the goal. And I think, again, you know, this is popping up all over on all these different issues. And I think this is our small piece of that larger effort to mobilize people.
There's also a breakout event with several speakers. Like, there's a protest to power. I wondered if you could tell us more about that. It says, where's my place in the movement?
Yeah.
And I think that's a big question for a lot of people. How do I act? What do I do?
Right.
There's so many legislative things going through so quickly. And you're calling your senator and your congressman, and maybe you're doing things on special organization petitions, and maybe you're even protesting.
Right.
But, you know, you're wondering, am I making a difference?
So, definitely. Well, I'm glad you brought that up because that is kind of the subtitle of the event, From Protest to Power. And what that really means to us is moving from just fighting these defensive battles and, you know, when the AHCA comes through, we all hit the phones and we try and stop it, and hopefully we succeed. But we know that we also have to go on the offensive and start winning things eventually. We want to win kind of people-first policies at the national and the state level. And so when we say from protest to power, we mean we know we got to do the protest stuff, we got to do the defensive battles, but we also want to take power and really start winning things again. So that specific workshop that you were talking about is going to be co-led by Alicia Garza, who I mentioned, co-founder of Black Lives Matter, and Bree Carlson from our national network, People's Action. And they're both kind of these powerhouse organizers who, you know, really have a lot of experience in the field of community organizing and making sure that all this work that we're doing is effective and that sort of thing. So that is really what the workshop is about, is what is this organizing thing we're talking about? How can we make sure we're most effective, and how can people plug in?
The titles of some of these breakout workshops speak for themselves. Climate in crisis, being undocumented and unafraid, healthcare, Medicare for all. But some of them are not so clear. Joy's mentioned one of them, and you've talked a bit about that, From Protest to Power. The other one that's not absolutely clear from the title is co-governance, doing politics differently.
Yeah,
I wonder if
definitely.
You could talk about that.
Yeah, I'm glad you asked about that one because that's actually the one I'm helping put together. And it is kind of a jargony word, but it really speaks to this vision that we have that elected officials should be working hand-in-hand with people's organizations. So again, this idea that we don't just elect someone, they go off, they take office, and they take it from here. You know, we can demobilize, we don't have to pay attention until the next election. But really, that everyday people should be involved in the political process every single day. Co-governance is the idea that if we elect people out of our movement, kind of movement leaders getting elected to office, that they would work hand-in-hand with people's organizations and continue to mobilize around the issues.
So it's just another way of saying keep working at this all the time, not just during election years.
Yeah, it's very closely related, and I think we'll really dig in on what that looks like in Chicago with CCI Action's sister organization called Reclaim Chicago. The two people speaking in that workshop are Will Guzzardi, who is a Illinois state representative, and Carlos Ramirez Rosa, who is a Chicago alderman. They do a lot of electoral work. They've elected some of their members to the Chicago as Chicago aldermen and Illinois state representatives. And they're talking about putting that vision into practice where they're working hand in hand with Reclaim Chicago and keeping people mobilized.
Keeping them mobilized all the year round.
Yes, that's right. Okay. That's right. No sleep, you know, until we got justice.
I wanted to ask you about climate and crisis.
Sure.
It says building the movement for just transition. Can you explain that?
Yeah, definitely. Just transition. That is the idea that we know that we have to transition away from fossil fuels towards clean energy. Climate change is real. It's happening already. And we need to make that transition, but it also has to be a just transition. Specifically, what we mean by that is it has to reach everyone. It can't just be if you can afford solar energy, if you can afford to put solar panels on your house or drive an electric car, that's still perpetuating the kind of inequalities in our economy. So what we want to see is 100% renewable energy for 100% of the people. And that's the only way we're going to solve climate change. And it goes a long way towards solving inequality as well.
One of the breakout groups is about healthcare. Fight for our lives, Medicare for all.
Yeah, I do think people across the spectrum recognize that the Affordable Care Act has problems that aren't just going to go away. And I think it's too bad that the situation we're in is what's creating the hope, but it's reopening this conversation about how do we fix these problems. It's definitely unfortunate that this discussion is happening at a time when Republicans control both houses of Congress and the presidency, but at least it is opening up a larger conversation going right back to what should we be fighting for, and then once we figure out what we want to be fighting for, we can figure out what can we win, how close can we get to that perfect vision. And for us, you know, it is a Medicare for all single payer system.
It seems to me that the public at large has started realizing that Affordable Care Act is quite popular. Actually, as you say, it's got faults. But people just don't want to lose it and repeal and replace it. And there's a lot of opposition to that. And so they want something better than that.
I am glad that the conversation is happening.
Mm-hmm. It just seems like this, especially this one about fighting for our lives, is important to everyone, no matter what party you're with.
Definitely.
And we all want the best health care we can get.
And we agree completely. You know, this is not a partisan event. You know, we have members who are Democrats, Republicans, Independent, all across the spectrum. And these, for us, it really is about people power versus corporate power. And there are people in all parties who believe in these issues.
Are these breakouts going to be spread out?
Are they concurrent or?
Yeah. So this is always a bit of a concern that people have is we have six workshops and there are two rounds of workshops. So of the six, you can attendees can go to two of them. But what we're doing this year is we're really hoping to record all six so that you can watch the ones that you weren't able to attend afterwards. Yeah, so you won't be able to see all of them in person, but that information will be available.
To what time does this start in the morning and how long are the workshops, that kind of thing, and when does it end in the afternoon?
Yeah, so again, Saturday, July 15th down at the Iowa Events Center in Des Moines. Starts at 9 a.m. The actual program starts at 9 a.m. You know, registration starts at 8. We'd recommend people get there a little early. The workshops are each an hour long. We have two plenary sessions, and we'll wrap up around 4:30 or 5. So it is an all-day event, but it'll be jam-packed, and, you know, we'll have a lunch there for everyone as well.
And it says, you know, it talks about that this is going to be exciting, that it's going to help people know the best action to take. Tell us something that's going to really make us want to come to this event. What are we going to get out of this?
Definitely. Well, I mean, it's going to be a ton of like-minded people. That's the thing I always love about convention. You know, it's hundreds and hundreds, and this year we're hoping for about 1,000 people of kind of all like-minded people who want to make the world a better place, who care about these people-first issues, all coming together and building community. And, you know, learning a lot of these workshops are always so informative. That's what I'm excited about for a convention. I also think if you love what you hear about CCI Action here, we always have events going on. So this week, every day this week, we went up to the federal building and we talked to Grassley's and Ernst's staff about the healthcare bill that's going through the Senate right now and saying, you know, that we oppose this. So we're always doing stuff. You know, this is definitely the biggest event of the year, but if you like what you hear, then there's opportunities every day to get involved. If people are interested in attending the event, you can find out more information and register on our website, cciaction.org /July15, and you can register online, or you can call our office 515-255-0800, and we can do over the phone as well.
If you just Google Revolution Iowa, yeah, it will lead you to this. And let's just remind people where it will be again.
Yeah, so this it'll be on July 15th at Hy-Vee Hall, which is in the Iowa Event Center in Des Moines, and it'll run from 9 a.m. to around 5 p.m.
We'll put the information on our website also.
The address there is 730 3rd Street, Des Moines.
You're listening to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. I'm your host for today, Ursula Rudenberg. Thank you, Kay and Joy B, for the report on Revolution Iowa. And thank you, Joy B, for joining the Local Talk reporting team. In March, the Iowa Board of Regents appointed Benjamin Allen as Iowa State University's interim president, effective May 9th. Dr. Allen succeeds President Stephen Leith, who accepted the presidency at Audubon University. Mr. Allen took over on May 8th and will remain the interim position until a new president begins at Iowa State University. Reporter Gail Seiler sat down with Dr. Allen last week to talk about his role as interim president at Iowa State and to ask about some specific issues that arose last year and will likely to continue into his interim tenure.
I'm speaking with Dr. Benjamin Allen, the ISU interim president. Thank you very much for being here with us and talking to KHOI. Can you just tell us a little bit of your background, a little bit about you?
Thank you for having me. I've been in higher education for all my life, basically. I graduated from college in 1969 and went immediately into the graduate school to become a PhD in economics with a slight diversion to the Army, drafted during the Vietnam War. So I went through the ranks of being an assistant professor at Washington State University. We had a child and we wanted to move back to the Midwest where our families were, so we came back to Iowa State, got almost back to Indiana, but not quite. And so in 79, we came here and as associate professor, directed a research center that was the University of Iowa and Iowa State Consortium, became dean of the College of Business. So I kind of went through the ranks and then later became provost at Iowa State. In 2006, I was asked to serve as president of the University of Northern Iowa, and I served there for 7 years and retired in 2013. And I was comfortably retired until the phone calls came in a little bit earlier this year. So
you have quite a history at ISU.
I do. I was here for 25, 26, 27 years. We left a couple times to take advantage of opportunities at University of Illinois Champaign-Urbana for a visiting professorship. I also went to University of Arkansas and endowed chair, but we decided we liked Iowa a lot better, and they made it very easy for me to come back. But so about 25, 26 years.
And how do you see the role of an interim president? Do you see it as kind of maintaining things, or are there particular initiatives that you want to work on while you're president?
I think there's a couple issues when you're serving as interim president. One is you clearly want to hand off the university to the next president in a way that is very helpful to that person. We want that next president to be successful. So there are probably some issues that I will handle in the interim that will take the pressure off the new president for having to handle those. This university has great momentum, so I clearly want to make sure that momentum is maintained. But also during a transition period, there's uncertainty, change of leadership. There's a change of leadership of the Board of Regents, a change of leadership of the government. We also have a number of initiatives on the HR arena, human resources, that I think is creating some angst on campus. So one of the things I'm trying to do here is to reassure the people that we'll get through this, we'll come out the other end when the new president comes on and kind of stabilize the situation a little bit.
Was it a difficult decision to decide to come out of retirement and take on the role of interim president? In some ways, it may seem to people like a thankless job, and yet you were willing to take it on.
Well, I was surprised to have been asked, quite honestly. And so when I got the phone calls, I did ask, well, is there someone on campus that could do this? And there were reasons given why that might not work out. I was honored to be asked, given that I was here for many years and I built my career here. So I think that's why I said, well, maybe I could give back a bit here to help out during this transition. I don't consider it a thankless job. It's been very positive response for me being here. You know, we're making decisions and hopefully we're making the right decisions. So I just find it a great opportunity to give back to Iowa State University.
So let's get into the meat of some questions now, if we can. The first one would be about ISU's enrollment. ISU's increasing enrollment has been putting some strains on students and on the Ames community related to classroom space, housing, changes in neighborhoods. But there's been a real push to continue to increase enrollment. Is that something that you'll continue? And people may wonder, why is increasing enrollment such a good thing?
Well, I guess I might take exception to the premise of that question. I don't think it's been a push for enrollment. I view it more as at least this is my perception, because I've not been here for 4 or 5 years in state, is that this particular university offers a selection of academic programs that are in great need right now. The science areas, the STEM areas, and it's very attractive to students. And secondly, it's a great student experience here at Iowa State. So I think it's a good place to be. People feel good about being here. So I don't think there's been necessarily a big push for more students. There's been a pull getting students here. That said, I think there is a strain on the system by having such a rapid growth. And when I came here in April to start visiting with people, everyone feels good about the growth of the university and kind of the vibrancy, but they also shared some concerns about the teaching loads, the class sizes, and in particular areas of campus, what you alluded to are simply the lab spaces. And so the deans have been working very effectively trying to deal with that in the short run, but clearly we need to address those. And, of course, we have some new buildings on campus to take some of that pressure from that situation.
And does the university work closely with the community? I'm thinking in terms of housing off campus. There's a lot of apartment building construction going on now. So is there co-planning around that kind of?
There's always been a history of some collaboration and working together with city leaders. One of the first people I met with when I came back to do this interim position was meet with Steve Schenker and talk about the relationship, the partnership between the city and the university. And I think there are some issues that we need to get together again to talk about, including the growth. So I think there used to be some joint planning going on. I'm not sure that's taking place now, but I would advise that for the moving forward to do more of that.
And then let's switch to a couple funding topics. So the Leopold Center is now in a precarious position because it was defunded in the last legislative session. Is the university committed to finding new funding sources for that center? And is that something that you'll be prioritizing during your interim tenure?
Well, that came up very suddenly, as you know, and I regret the decision that was made. Now, that said, I also thank the governor for at least changing some of that legislation to allow it to continue to exist. The challenge, as you highlighted, is funding those projects. We have graduate students that are being funded, and so Dean Winterstein has been working very effectively to make sure that those graduate students can find other places in the system to find employment and continue their studies. They obviously have quite a bit of private funding, but that's not a steady core funding of the center. They are going through a process to vision for the Leopold Center moving forward. How do we operate with only private money? We obviously have to be a bit more aggressive in looking for foundation help, not ISU Foundation, but other help. So it's not clear what the future holds, but there is a process in place that will help define that future.
What other thoughts do you have on funding? There were some funding cuts to higher ed in Iowa this past session. So what thoughts do you have on that, or looking forward to what you think might take place in the coming session?
A good question. We had a number of years here where state funding was positive each year, positive change, maybe not significant increases, but helpful. It is always disappointing that the state won't continue funding. We understand the other challenges and the other pressures on the budget. But what it does, it puts additional pressure on people here who've been working so hard. The population growth, up to 10,000 more students, but yet the state funding per student is now going down, obviously. And so that creates some challenges. We are now working through how do we position a tuition package moving forward that will address those shortfalls, but yet be sensitive to the pressures, financial pressures faced by students and their parents. So I think this setback, so to speak, has made us kind of stop and reflect about what are we doing and what can we continue doing, how do we prioritize a bit better. So it's made the decision-making a bit more difficult.
And I'd like to ask about a few things that came up during the past year that I think will potentially arise again during the next year. Black and Hispanic students have been calling attention to negative experiences and campus climate at ISU, and I think it's safe to say we're not entirely satisfied with President Leith's response. How will you approach these issues of diversity and inclusivity on campus?
Of course, it's important to note that climate issues everywhere. As you said, on many campuses and on TV, just you name it, it's very frustrating, and people feel threatened and fatigued by it. So I take the approach, obviously we have a number of programs that will continue hopefully addressing those issues, and I won't rehearse those at the long list, including, I think, part four of our strategic plan has a number of pieces that if we address those that will help. But at a personal level, I like to reach out. I've already met with leaders of the Black Student Alliance to get ahead of the game a little bit, to talk with them, what are the issues, build some trust, and build a relationship before the fall. What they told me was that doing the campus climate survey is important, but that's just a piece. That they said that I should be more visible, that I should be out there, accessible. It's good advice. That's how I operate. So I look forward to working with other student groups and meeting with them before the fall semester. So I've just tried to be as genuine as I can be, authentic, I guess the word is, and accessible. And so I think I just need to be visible out there.
There's also been concern about speakers on campus who are viewed as promoting hate and hate speech, and other students protesting their presence. What are your thoughts on those kinds of situations?
Well, I went to a meeting of the APLU, which is the Organization of Public Land-Grant Universities, about 3 weeks ago, and half the program was on issues related to that question, in terms of how do you provide the opportunity for free speech, First Amendment, but also make sure everyone feels safe and secure. It's a challenging issue. And I think what I'm doing here, by the way, is actually having some meetings with the top administration before fall again to say, okay, these are the different pieces of that particular question. This is how do we handle those conflicting views sometimes. My concern is that we have a safe, welcoming campus. So how do we maintain that, but yet respect the rights of people who, in the name of free speech, will make people uncomfortable and feel unsafe? And I don't have it resolved yet, but I'm meeting the top team here to make sure we have a game plan moving forward.
And one of the other things that students of color were calling for was diversity training or anti-bias, anti-racism training for all faculty members. Is that something that you think is important? Or how can faculty members educate themselves around those issues, perhaps, if there's not that kind of training?
Well, I think training is probably a necessary piece of that, but not sufficient to deal with it. I've been meeting with Red Stewart, the Vice President for Diversity and Inclusion. I think he's preparing some type of training video or of some sort for new faculty, which I think is at least a step forward on that. It doesn't address everyone else who's here, and so how do we scale that up to make that happen? And I have not had conversations about that particular issue with the Faculty Senate, which is always a necessary step. Obviously, training can be done by person reading, by talking with people, by listening, by trying to understand, but that training does provide some structure to that effort. So I think it's a necessary but not sufficient condition to address the issue.
Near the end of the school year, some concerns also arose about involvement of ISU in purchasing items that were made using prison labor. Is that something that you've looked into?
Well, I didn't know that was an issue until I got here in April. And when I met with a number of people about any issue, that came up. And it came up, I think, first with Dr. Harmon, when I met with him, who's the Senior Vice President for Student Affairs. And so I looked into the issue a little bit in the context of Iowa, and it's a complex issue, and one that highlights some of the issues in Iowa. I think it has the highest incarceration rate of people of color in the country. It's not something you want to be proud of, so there's issues related to that. There's issues related to how much the inmates are paid to do the work. How do you justify that? When I drill down into the data, the positives would be for Iowa in general, people, when they leave prison, tend to stay out of prison a bit better than the nation's average. People who participate in this program actually even do better. But I think it's one that we have to have conversations on in the fall. It's too complex for me to have more people at the table to talk about it. But I think it came up late last spring. I'm sure we'll pick that up in the fall and come to some type of conclusion.
Just to kind of wrap things up, what would you say is your style of leadership?
If someone wants to really get detailed information about that, read a book by Stephen Sample, former president of Southern California. It's called The Contrarian Leader. So my leadership is, hopefully, style is to be inclusive, to be analytical. I probably drive people crazy by asking a lot of questions before I make a decision. I like to put off making a decision until I have as much facts as possible. I'm an economist, so I like data. But I do believe that, you pick this up from reading books like Team of Rivals, and is that you surround yourself with people smarter than yourself, take advantage of that. And so I involve a lot of teamwork in my decision making based on that assumption. And so I hope I listen well. At the end of the day, I have to make the decision.
And so if people do want to communicate with you, say, how should they do that?
Well, I'm still probably old-fashioned. I do email. I'll say that it's listed in the public records there. It's B.J. Allen, Iowa State. And phone calls still work. And if they see me on campus or in the community, stop me and say, hey, I got an issue. Better yet, a solution. and I'd like to chat.
Thank you very, very much for speaking with us, and we wish you the best of luck this year.
Well, thank you.
And you're listening to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. I'm your host for today, Ursula Rudenberg. Thank you, Gail Seiler, for that report with interim ISU President Dr. Allen. Story County Emergency Coordinator Keith Morgan is here. Welcome, Keith.
Good
welcome,
morning.
Welcome back, I should say. You brought the Ames Animal Control Supervisor with you today. Would you introduce him?
Yeah, we've got Ron here, who's from the Ames Animal Control. Great asset to Ames. comes to us from Los Angeles, and I'll talk a little bit about that in the future. But he's here, and we thought we'd talk about, with this heat that we've got outside, we'd start off by talking about pets in the heat and some things to watch out for. So, Ron, if you got a few words you'd like to say about that.
Sure, absolutely. Thanks for having me here today. I really appreciate the time. This last year, we had over 150 pets left in vehicles during hot weather. So these are times that the animal control officers had to respond and found that animals were left in unsafe conditions. So that is obviously a very dangerous situation that we want to prevent, and we want to see those numbers decrease this year. Unfortunately, we're not heading in an area where we're decreasing those numbers. We've already had over 50 since the weather warmed up this year. So we're,
wow.
we're
so that's little, within the last month.
It is. And, you know, we think, you know, there's, of course, still several months where we have potentially dangerous and absolutely dangerous warm weather that, you know, could kill animals.
How do you find out about these cases?
Well, we have a great responsible pet community here in Ames, and a lot of people call us up, and they'll stand there and wait at the car. They even call the police department and 911 when they see animals in distress in vehicles. So we tend to see them at a lot of the big shopping centers here in the city, mm-hmm. and our animal control officers respond just as quick as we can and get out there and try to make contact with the owner. Of course, when they're in these big shopping centers, sometimes it's very difficult to find them. So oftentimes we do end up removing the animals from the car with the assistance of the Ames Police Department.
So just everyday citizens will see animals in distress in the parking lot and call you.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And it's just such a dangerous situation. There has been so much social media, newscast, radio shows about the dangers of leaving pets and children in cars over the years. It's kind of, I would say, frustrating to say the least, to still have this in 2017, where people are still doing this, putting their pets and their children, quite honestly, in danger of losing their lives because they're going shopping in a store and can't leave the pets at home.
So what creates a dangerous situation for a pet?
Well, it does.
In a car.
Sure. The heat, the sun actually acts in the vehicle. It actually is almost kind of a microwave situation. So with the heat in there, and even if you crack the windows, we oftentimes hear people, you know, I was just in the store 5 minutes and the windows are cracked. That essentially does nothing for the dogs. And typically we see dogs, although we have found some cats in the vehicle. What a dog needs to do to be able to cool down is to have cool air pass over the dog's tongue. So if there's not any good cool air flowing through the vehicle, you're not going to be able to cool that dog and regulate its temperature. Quite honestly, people can survive better in a car than dogs can. People can sweat. Dogs do not sweat like people do. So, of course, we don't want humans left in cars either, and especially children.
But harder for a dog.
It is harder for a dog.
They're also wearing a fur coat.
Absolutely. And it's interesting, when we make contact with these pet owners, we often see them coming out of the store with their shorts and their tank tops. So they've dressed appropriately for the summer weather that we're having, which is blistering. But clearly their, you know, long-haired, shaggy dog is not dressed appropriately for the weather. And we hear people say that they don't like to be left alone at home. Well, when we arrived on the scene, your dog was left alone inside the car, stressed out, overheating in this, you know, horrible situation. So it really doesn't make any sense to say they don't like to stay at home. At least at home, the temperature is controlled. They're in a familiar environment. There's not people peering into the windows, and we don't have to break into your vehicle to get the animal out to save its life.
So if you love them, leave them at home.
Absolutely. It's so easy. And even if you think you might need to stop at a store, leave them at home, because there's always that chance, you know, mm-hmm. that something could happen and you're putting their lives at risk and in danger.
If you leave the animal in the car and open the windows, does that work for the animal?
Again, it's a situation where if there's not cool air that's passing over the tongue, then that car is going to heat up in a very short period of time. We've actually seen cases where the temperature inside the vehicle was well over 140 degrees.
Even with the windows open?
With the windows cracked. Mm-hmm. And a sunroof, people think that the heat can escape from that sunroof, and that's really not the case. It just continues to heat up like a greenhouse effect.
Mm-hmm. So a car in the summer is not a good place for a dog to be.
No, and I use a roll, and it may be, some people may think that's just, it's not hot enough or that it's too extreme. But I say if it's anything above 65 degrees, leave them at home. Mm-hmm. It's just a simple rule that I follow. And there's just no sense in putting their life at risk and for us to go out there and respond. And there's some hefty fines. If you go out there and find you've left your pet in a situation that may endanger their life, we're going to issue citations. They're going to have to go to court and explain to a judge why they made a stupid mistake.
So there are consequences legally.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm.
You know, it's interesting what you said about the tongue and how the dog needs to have cool air pass on the tongue. You see the dog, when dogs are in cars driving, they'll throw their heads, they'll stick their heads out of the window. And a lot of time there, you see their tongue sticking out. And to some degree, it seems the dog does it because it enjoys, out of joy, but possibly it's also doing it to cool itself off.
Sure. Right? It's also regulating its temperature, much as you and I would fan ourselves or, take a layer of clothes off. That's the way to cool down, and that's what they do.
Because the car is a hot place to be, and so it's cooling itself down.
Absolutely.
That's very interesting.
Yeah.
Okay. And what about pets in disasters? This segment of the show is about disasters.
Sure.
Talk to us about that.
Well, the most important thing that I can tell your listeners is that they need to prepare in advance. Once a disaster hits, if we have a tornado, flooding, that's not the time to then put together your pet emergency kit. And, of course, we're assuming that they also have their human emergency kits and they're ready to go at any time.
Well, Keith has made sure of that.
Yes. Keith is excellent at making sure that happens. He's got everyone following what he says.
So what do you need to do for your pet?
Well, pets just as like you would with your kit that you would have yourself. You need to make sure you have some food available, prepare for several days' worth of food,
mm-hmm.
That you obviously keep rotating just as you would with the human food. Make sure you're watching expiration dates. Any medications that you have, you want to make sure you have an extra set of leash, collars, identification tags. And I can go on and on about identification tags. They should be on your pet at all times. It's actually required by law, by city code and state code. So at no time should your pet not have a tag and collar on. But it's even more important during a disaster because fences are blown over, things happen, pets get away. We need to know how to get them back to people. So you want to make sure your information is current. Microchipping is always a really good thing to do. You want to make sure you keep your information current, though, if you do get a microchip. We see a lot of microchip pets that have phone numbers that were from 10 years ago, and we can't get a hold of people. So you want to make sure that information is current. But just having those supplies, having that pet carrier, pet taxi, having those things available, so if there is a disaster, you're able to get your pet safely out and get to safety, with yourself and your family. We've seen through a lot of disasters across the United States where people have not left disaster areas because they want to stay there with their pets.
That's right.
And, if you're talking about your dog or cat, that's something you could hopefully easily transport out. But if you have livestock, and I know Keith's going to talk a little bit about livestock, it's not like you can load up your car with your 50 head of cattle.
Mm-hmm.
So you want to make sure you have plans for them as well. And again, it's just that matter of planning ahead. You can't wait till the last minute. You can't wait till, and you can't rely on agencies like the Ames Animal Shelter or the Story County Shelter to come in and solve all the problems. During a disaster, we are going to be just absolutely going from, one place to the next doing disaster response and recovery. We're not going to be able to help every single animal. So if we can get people to help their own animals, that'll leave us to do some of the work with some of the other animals that we can help in the community.
Another important part of that disaster kit, have a up-to-date record of your shots, because we will, in Story County, where we're working with Ron and some other organizations to be able to set up pet shelters, just like we set up human shelters. But as a big part of that, it's going to be knowing what kinds of vaccinations those animals have had. Because if they haven't had vaccinations, then we're probably going to have to give them another full set of vaccinations to protect all the animals. In the 2008 floods, they sheltered over 370 animals just in the Cedar Rapids area, because the people had had were in the shelters, and we can't have anything but service animals in a human shelter, so they set up a separate pet shelter for those animals that are displaced. But we've got to have those key things, and hopefully the people that are in the human shelters will be able to come over and help out with our pet shelters.
So if they don't have records of the animals, do they have to give them shots as if they didn't have the shots?
Sure. If we don't have any verification that animals are currently vaccinated, we're going to want to make sure that they are protected, because especially when you have them coming in from so many different areas and different backgrounds and things, you know, the worst thing we want is during a disaster is for now an animal to get something get sick. It's going to be a stressful situation to begin with.
Yeah.
And we know what happens when animals are stressed, just like people.
Mm-hmm.
Their immune system tends to go down, and so they can't fight off something they normally would.
And we may think that this is something that's not really going to happen. Ron has been through quite a few situations when he was working out in California, wildfires and like that. And he's a great asset for us to have here to be able to guide us as we think through these situations. So we appreciate having his experience here.
How long have you been with us, Ron?
I've been with the Ames shelter now for 4 years. Actually, August will be 4 years.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been in this the animal control, animal care industry for 32 years now.
Mm-hmm.
So by far, the majority of my career was in California. I was born and raised in California. Responded to quite a few earthquakes. It's kind of nice to be here in Iowa where the ground's not shaking every day.
Yeah, well, wait till the tornado starts.
I have not had to deal with that yet, but I'm going to be right there with Keith, and we're going to prepare and be ready to help our community if something like that happens here.
Where in California are you from?
Southern California, Los Angeles area.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So, Keith, talk to us about livestock.
You know, we often think about just the pets, but there's an awful lot, being an agricultural county like we are, that the livestock producers also need to have a plan. You can call it a business continuity plan or whatever, but we need the producers to think through all of the different eventualities, all the way from not being able to get feed to their stock in the wintertime. Yes, wintertime is going to happen again. Roads will be blocked. things like that can happen. Or should we have a long-term power outage because they're in the more rural areas? What critical things do they need to be able to overcome should they lose any part of the support process? The other thing is the avian flu outbreak is just 2 years ago. They really need to be reviewing their biosecurity all the time and making sure that many of these have employees, educate them on what their business continuity plans are, biosecurity, keep reinforcing that so that we can protect ourselves as much as possible. Another aspect that we've had here, unfortunately, three times, is animal transportation incidences where a semi transporting animals will get into an accident. We are extremely fortunate to have ISU Vet Med here, who has come out every time that we've asked them to and helped us through those situations to try and take care of the animals as humanely as we possibly can.
What kind of animals are we talking about?
We've had two with cattle and one with hogs on it. And obviously some of the animals are going to be injured. Having Vet Med that can come out and care for those animals and if need be euthanize the animals. Again, we have seen some outstanding situations where in one case the transport company had a trailer that was one that they went and got and helped us take care of those animals, get them offloaded, get them onto another trailer, and then get them to their final destination. Another great thing we've got here in Story County, many of the producers have also helped us out. We had one instance where we had a transport accident in the middle of a blizzard, and we had two cattle producers that helped us out with gooseneck trailers to move the cattle. They actually took care of the cattle until the weather cleared and they could get moved on to their destination. It's always got to be a community kind of activity where we take care of each other, and that's where animal producers, if they can work with each other and have plans to back each other up, should there be a problem at one of the producing sites, that's the sort of forward thinking that we need when we're starting to think about disasters, how to take care of each other. Can't always rely, like Ron was saying, don't rely on the government to come and help you out. We're going to be very busy with a lot of other stuff.
Mm-hmm.
If you can take care of yourself as much as possible and just a little bit of assistance from us, we'll all be much better off.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's always kind of your central message, Keith, is to prepare for a disaster. It's kind of like, you know, fix the roof before it rains, right?
Oh, exactly. And, and if we can, you know, we're trying to set up volunteers in disaster to be able to take care of pets. We need to really partner with some sort of an agency, maybe FFA or a 4-H if they're like an agency out there like that, that we'd like to work with them and train them on how to help us set up a pet shelter and to be that cadre for a pet shelter immediately after a disaster. We try and put those nearby where our human shelters are so that the people can come and visit, but we really need those people who know how to deal with animals that are very stressed out. I think you'll agree that that's an important part of it.
Absolutely, yeah, it's very difficult. And not just the animals being away from their people, but the people away from their animals. That's a very stressful time, and you figure during a disaster the stress levels are already so high, so being able to see them and be close to them is very important.
Okay, so give a website, phone number.
We're on the Story County website. If you go to their website and then look for emergency management, we're underneath there. My phone number is 515-382-7315. Give us a call if you or your organization is interested in helping out with pets and disasters, and we'll start the process to help you help us.
Again, that's 515-382-7315, and that's Keith Morgan, the Emergency Services Coordinator. And we've been speaking with Keith and Ron Edwards.
Yes.
From the, get your official title here, you're the Ames Animal Control Supervisor.
Correct.
Yep.
Thank you, Ron. And Ron, you'll come back and talk with us some more?
Absolutely.
Okay, thank you. And thank you, Keith.
No problem.
You've been listening to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. I've been your host today, Ursula Rudenberg. Thank you for listening. Earlier in the show, we heard from Patch Larbaum on the Gray Fox, Evan Berger on the Revolution Iowa Conference coming up next weekend, and an interview with ISU President, Interim President Allen. Local Talk airs at 7 a.m., noon, and 7 p.m. here on KHOI at 89.1 FM. Also, remember that you can hear us on the web at khoifm.org and find links to guests and information you heard during the program, including the emergency services. KHOI is streaming on khoifm.org, and you can hear a repeat of this show online today later after our webmaster is able to put it online. Our theme song is Backtrackin' by Al Harris and Tom Richards. Cynthia McClure was our engineer. Thank you, Cynthia. And remember, you, the listener, are what makes KHOI meaningful and possible. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you again on the radio.
Opportunities throughout Ames and Story County at workinames.com. Again, that's workinames.com.